right.
Romans chapter 2. You should have two handouts today. Do you?
Sure.
I read a part of this last Sunday. The late James Montgomery Boyce. I'll read it again. At first glance, the opening words of Romans 2 seem redundant. An echo of what we've already seen in the letter. In Romans 1:20, after Paul has explained how men and women suppress the truth about God, which God has revealed in nature, Paul concludes by saying, so, men are without excuse. Now he says the same thing. You, therefore, have no excuse. As he continues to build the case, and that's the purpose of these two chapters, to build the case that all persons, whoever, that's all you perfect saints included, all persons, whoever they are, or whatever they have or have not done, are under God's judgment. Paul is not being redundant, of course, as we will see, but even if he were, the point of the repetition is well taken. Paul's repetition dramatizes the fact that human beings, tune in please on this one, because we're all guilty, human beings never seem able fully to admit their wrongdoing and never tire of making excuses for their bad behavior. Dale Carnegie, in his perennial bestseller, How to Win Friends and Influence People, bases his approach to people management on the premise that others rarely admit to having done anything wrong, and that it is therefore pointless to criticize them. My favorite example, Boyce says, is from the book, or from this book by Dale Carnegie, is a saying of Al Capone, and I read this many months back in this series earlier. The saying by Al Capone, the Chicago gangland leader, who for years was the Federal Bureau of Investigation's public enemy number one. Capone was as sinister as they come. Hardened killer. But he said of himself, quote, I have spent the best years of my life giving people the lighter pleasures, helping them to have a good time, and all I get is abuse, the existence of a hunted man. Carnegie's point, obvious, mine as well, is that people habitually attempt to excuse their wrong behavior. If as hardened a man as Al Capone thought well of himself, how much more do the normal, morally upright people of our society think well of themselves? And this is why Romans 2 was written. It's so easy, as you sit through the list or read through the list of the 21 sins in the previous chapter, it is so easy to say, well, at least I'm not like that. I'm better than that. And that's why, to read the King James, you have the Greek in front of you, therefore thou art inexcusable, O man, whosoever thou art that judgest. For wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest thyself, for thou that judgest dost the same things. Now, we've been camped out on just the first phrase. I'm going to get to the second phrase today. I commented to Melissa on the way here. a lack of enthusiasm that I have and had that made me almost skip over these chapters for dealing with this subject. It's not something that makes people want to jump up and dance and run around the church and have Jericho marches in the old-fashioned revival sense. It isn't something when the preacher gets done, you say, oh, I feel so blessed. In fact, when I got into the first verse of chapter 2, I had some calls relayed to me of two or three in the congregation that talked to someone on my staff. They went home scared to death. Good. Good. Maybe you will stop and say, I'm not okay, except in Jesus. When we come to Romans 8, you will see it's synonymous. When Christ by His Spirit is in you, you are in Christ. And only in that state are you safe. And yet, that state, for most Christians, including a lot in this congregation, that state is in the past tense. A one-time experience, an occasional experience. Now, surely I've taught enough here. Christ is formed in your heart. How? Not by creed. Faith is, the Scripture defines it, an action based upon belief sustained with confidence. Only faith in keeps you in Christ. And judging is not a faithing act. Let me say that again. Judging is not a faithing act. Yet most Christians spend more time judging than they do faithing. You know, the statement, why is this happening to me, is a judging act. It's not a question. It's a rhetorical statement that comes from a cesspool heart. Well, it shouldn't be happening to me. And therefore, why is this happening to me, calls for the answer, it shouldn't be. Because I'm special. And what's worse, you're judging God. Why is this happening to me is a rhetorical question saying, I do it. All of us do it. You shouldn't be letting this happen to me. Not really a question, it's an accusation. Judging is the most natural trait of humankind. Because we have a mind. We judge. Now the word in the Greek, as you see in front of you, is krino. The Greek word krino, from which derivatives galore flow out. And krino is encountered all through the New Testament. We encounter it often here because I teach on the table of the Lord. And the word form in 1 Corinthians 11 is krema, temporary judging, to prevent ultimate judgment, katakrama, which comes upon the world in the, as stated in the close of that chapter. All these words come from the verb krino. This is scary when I pull this book out. Theological Dictionary of the New Testament. Krino. The word is related in root to Latin cerno, to sunder. In the basic sense, to part, to sift, to cut, and this leads to the sense to divide out, to select, and to decide. The relationship of the root is even clearer in verbal forms and derivatives. Kekrika, ekkrithine, kritis, krisis, in the Latin, crevi, cretum, cremen, crebrum. But let me go to English. This word, creno, is the basis of a lot of interesting English words. Language is what makes us different from the rest of creation, among other things, but it's a principle item of difference. It's what makes the Western religious faith different from Eastern religions. We don't seek God in some trance-like state where we lose consciousness and become one with some ultimate reality that cannot be defined, that which is behind all that. The ultimate religious experience is a dialogue relationship with God our Father throughout the eternities. There'll be dialogue. He talks with us and we talk with Him, the old song. And He walks with me and He talks with me emphasizes that. You could not have deep relationships with any other person, and God is personal, without language and words and talk. Now, I'm sure some sour marriages wish that talk was not part of our expressive ability. But anyone in love knows you want to talk. Words are the means by which God has declared He will bless His people. Words created everything. Words sustain everything. Words will recreate everything. Thy word forever, O Lord, is settled in heaven. Philosophers, and I am trained to be one, pay attention to words and their meanings. I love this little book, Dictionary of Word Origins. Creno. Am I boring you already? Look at some of the words. Or creno. Let's see. Well, cremate's not one of them. Crime. Now, I think that's interesting. That's the first word I find as I go through this book based on creno. Crime. Crime is one of a wide range of English words, including certain, crisis, critic, decree, discern, discreet, discriminate, and sieve, riddle, secret, and secretary, which come ultimately from or are related to the Greek crinine, decide, a relative of the Latin cinere, decide, from which evolved the noun crimen, judgment, accusation, illegal act, and on into the French and the English. Critic. Am I boring you? These are kinds of activities that express crino, critic. Critic and crisis both come ultimately from the Greek verb krinon, decide. Latin cinere, decide. English certain, crime, decree, discern, discreet. The Greek derived the noun crisis or judgment. The Greek derived noun, rather, crisis or judgment, was used by the physicians, Hippocrates and Galen, for quote, the turning point of a disease. It passed as a medical term via Latin, crisis, in the more general modern sense until the 17th century, and then it took on the reported meaning of today, crises. Well, let's see what else we can find. Why don't you just give me the book and let me go home? But I think it's out of print. Nobody getting this book from me. Decide. I'm working around what it is that God is condemning. Etymologically, decide denotes the resolving of alternatives or difficulties by cutting through them as if with a knife or a sword, dealing with them at a stroke. The Latin verb, the French verb, with the prefix de, which is off, and cadere, to cut or strike. And we get from this chisel, concise, excise, incision, precise, even scissors. Am I boring you? Discern. Ultimately from the same source. No sense reading all of them again. I think you're going to like the next one. Excrement. That puts what comes out of this judging activity in perspective. I've often said, don't give me constructive criticism. Every so often I have some nitwit out there that thinks that he can give me constructive criticism, like one recently down in Texas. Thinks that I'm going to pay attention to what he says about how to run my ministry. I even had an editorial written once in the Glendale News Press, or whatever they call that paper, of defining how a cleric should act, in which they listed all the things that I did as contrary to how a cleric should act. I do not pay any attention to constructive criticism because I've never ever gotten any. Critics are on an egomaniac trip. They haven't the guts to face their calling, which is either to be a follower or to be a point man. If they're a point man, get out there and build a church and do it. Don't try to tell somebody else how to do it. God gave some apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and teachers for the perfecting of the saints, not the other way around. Well, I don't like that. Right? That, you're judging God. That's the way he laid it down. If you don't like it, take it up with him. Tell him to change the method. Volunteer yourself for a call so you can build a church your way, and then he might learn something. You see, constructive criticism forms the root of the word excrement. And thus, you know why most of the time this judging, gossiping behavior is a four-letter word made fancy right here. Got it? But if you really want to know what Paul's talking about, all of those things trace back to the Old Testament root words that transition and are unfolded into the New Testament. Hebrew's been around a long time. But when they translated the Old Testament into Greek, the Septuagint, in those 2 to 3 centuries prior to Christ's coming, in God's master plan, he was picking the time in history when the cradle of language meaning spread abroad in the world of that day was a very precise language, the Greek. And the only Bible the New Testament had, and the only Bible the apostles used, and the only Bible Jesus read from, was the Old Testament. And Hebrew, essentially, was only understood by the priests and the scholars. Aramaic was the common tongue. Greek, the universal language, as there will be a common tongue, a colloquial Spanish, if you are of Mexican heritage. But the universal language of today's world, you don't fly international airplane carriers and talk in Spanish in whatever country you go to. What French was, English became, and is now the world universal language. In that day, there was Hebrew for the learned, Aramaic, Latin because of the Romans, but the language of the street, they used to call Greek, classical Greek and biblical Greek until they learned the biblical Greek did not exist. What they called biblical Greek was Koine Greek, the common colloquial Greek of the marketplace, the home, business transactions. And that Koine Greek, under God's inspiration in the New Testament, which we're teaching from, got its meaning for the Greek words being used, theological, from that translation of the Old Testament from Hebrew to Greek, which gave precision of meaning to the Old Testament words, but you still have to go back to the seed or the embryo of revelation in the Old Testament from which the words grew, which were translated to Greek, and you work from the Greek back to the Hebrew to find the consistent meaning of the word through Scripture. And as we found in righteousness, dike, we had to go to the Old Testament, tzedek, to get the meaning of righteousness as God decreed it in both the Old and New Testament. It has no meaning, I repeat, apart from a relationship. There's people, and then there's covenant people. God made a covenant with Adam and Eve. A covenant's a contract. And God's covenant always had blessing if you keep it, cursing if you don't. He gave to Adam and Eve the whole earth and entered into constant fellowship with them. And life was immortal. The covenant would not release God's ultimate authority. He didn't just turn a wild man and a wild woman loose. He created them in a relationship. It's amazing to me as I look at that story why they would forfeit it all to cross the line of the one thing he said no to. You can have everything, just don't touch this tree. That tree became the thing they wanted the most because it reined them in. It set limits on their self-will. It drew a circle around something they were denied. All this yes, this one no. They broke the covenant. And all mankind suffers a consequence. Born apart from God, in the clutches of evil forces, Satan and his minions, who by default became the prince of the power of the air and the ruler of this world, in absence of Adam and Eve fulfilling their original created purpose or reason for being. All of us are born then as helpless, as dropped in the middle of a rushing river, the currents of which are so strong, all of our efforts cannot get us to the shore. All of us need rescue. And the rescue was planned before the worlds were created. A lamb slain in the foundation, from the foundation of the world. But God, after destroying the world with a flood, and from the line, the high priestly line through the blessed line Shem, he picked a man and went into covenant relationship with him. A new covenant with Abram and his seed, through which he would fulfill the ultimate redemption covenant. And with those covenant people, God elaborated a detailed covenant with curses if they didn't keep it, and life eternal if they did. And it was a covenant of doing. It called for perfection. And God was the definer of righteousness, the definer of the deeds that qualified as righteousness, the definer of the terms. He's still the boss. They thought he wasn't, and listened to the devil, and disbelieved God, and they defied his bossship. That's what it was all about. They wanted to be boss, and Satan knew how to tempt them. You won't die. You'll be like God. God chose a man and his descendants, particular ones of them, and entered into a new covenant, a covenant of doing, the covenant of law. Now, Paul discerns in this very book, as we will see, that God knew what he was doing. They had listened to the devil who said, eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. In other words, come to know good and evil, and you'll be like God because you'll choose good and not evil. And thus, knowledge will make you like God. Paul discerns that this covenant with Abraham was designed as a school teacher to teach them that his objective standard of righteousness was impossible to keep. All would fall short and be driven to a point that Paul will emphasize in the 7th chapter of seeing and recognizing what I would do, knowledge of the law, I see it, I'm ahead of the chapters in Romans 7, my head agrees with the law. I see that it's right. And my heart responds in that I want to do it. Yet I find myself not doing it. And what I would do, I find I'm not doing. And what I would not do, I find I'm doing. I therefore, Paul says in the 7th chapter of Romans, I perceive there's some law, nomos, some law in my being. Law used in the sense of power, like the law of gravity, that is stronger than us and holds our feet to the floor. We can't fly. We can't float. The law, I perceive there's a law that holds me down. He perceived a law in his members that overpowered him until he says, amazingly, it's not even I doing it. Because I agree with the law and I want to do it. But when I try, I'm not doing it, so there's some law in my members that takes me into captivity and keeps me from doing what I want to do, which is in agreement with God's law and standard, and keeps me doing what I don't want to do. Therefore, there is in my members another force that controls me. That's what Paul said the law was given for, to teach those that were responsive at all to God and wanted to please him and live up to his standard, impossible. There's something in us. The world, the flesh, and the devil is too much for the goodest of man to conquer. He then cries out at the end of the 7th chapter, who shall deliver me from the body of this death? That, Paul says, is the purpose of the old covenant. Paul says it was given as a school teacher Because God knew it could not be kept, but He would keep His word if someone fooled God and kept it. Life. But to fall short, death. And Paul started this Roman letter proclaiming the wonderful news of the gospel. I've got good news for you. He's moving toward the third chapter. All need this gospel. Because all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And he starts with what appears to be the worst in the first chapter. Those who have ignored God's presence, His tracks in the universe, and God just turns them over to these other forces. And the 21 sins flow horrifically through the chapter. And he anticipates both the moral Greeks and Romans and the Jews that he'll get more specific toward later in the chapter are going to look at that and say, well, I agree, they need the gospel. If God, now that His Son has arrived and fulfilled the plan, can reach forth with this message, there is forgiveness for them. Jesus died for everybody. He bought, as the parable says, the whole field, the whole world, to get the treasure out of the field. That means that all those people turned over by God under His present wrath because of their failure to recognize Him, worship Him, and thank Him. Even the sinners that ultimately end up in hell forever, they're owned by Jesus. They discards, but He bought them. He didn't pay a price limited in its amount. He bought the whole field. He doesn't want the whole field. He ain't going to take the whole field. I don't care what you say about whosoever will. There are some that God doesn't want. He bought the whole field, the wanted and the unwanted, to get what He wanted. And ahead of the story, those that will trust Him. But we tend to separate the field. And we dwell in our little postage stamp corner that however bad we are, we're better than all the rest. That's the attitude of judging in this second chapter. And the reason I've spent so much time on judging is like the Old Testament concept of righteousness, it makes no sense. God not even interested in any definition of righteousness. Be it an evil witch of a Greek goddess enforcing Zeus's will, be it some natural emanation, as the Greek philosopher Solon would have it, a natural emanation of divine law, unchangeable, that we must philosophically come to understand and measure ourselves by. Or the Stoics, with their high morality, God not even interested in any of that. Ethically, you might want to take a cruise with this person and not that person. And ethically, this person with a respect for life is a better companion than a murderer who has no more respect for life than a cockroach. But that has nothing to do with righteousness. Righteousness is what God says it is, and righteousness is in a covenant relationship that He makes with the people. And He has laid down a standard to teach. Nobody can rise to His performance level. Nobody. Well then, why have it? Well, it's to teach us our need of deliverance. And to those that don't see their need of deliverance and grab the deliverance through faith, it becomes a criteria of ultimate judgment when the secrets of the heart are revealed at the white throne judgment of God and the books are opened and every deed is measured and no one passes the test. We don't go to the white throne judgment. Jesus represents us there. He already paid the price for those that accept Him. We have what commentaries tend to confusingly say for the average Christian, the Bema judgment. There is the judgment seat of Christ, the Bema coming from a particular stone in place of judgment in the city of Corinth. But throughout Scripture, we Christians, we appear before the judgment seat of Christ, where the differences of rewards in eternity are measured out. We don't all float on the same space of eternal air. We do not all receive the same rewards. We will give account to the one who died for us at the judgment seat of Christ. All the rest of the world will appear, the dead raised, and appear at the white throne judgment, where this very covenant of perfection becomes their measurement, and as Romans 3:23 is going to declare, all have sinned and come short. God is the owner. God is the covenant maker. God lays down the terms. God judges the performance. And all fall short. That covenant and that writing of ordinances was nailed to the tree. Christ paid the penalty for all of us. The penalty being death for sin. And is raised to deliver to us the same Spirit that raised up Christ from the dead. And a new covenant is struck where God relates to us now exclusively on trust. From trusting to trusting, from faith to faith. Now as we walk this walk, righteousness now is a gift of His presence in us, a gift of His life. Able to express God's nature through us progressively, continuously, as we walk from faith to faith. And in that walk, judging comes up. Again, it has no meaning apart from the covenant relationship. And we have words out of the Old Testament. As Sedeq taught us righteousness, Shapot is the one most often used for judging that is translated with the Greek krino in the Septuagint. Krino also translates Dan or Din, the tribe that was named Dan because he will judge his people. But Dan has a more strictly legal setting. Reeb, that's more a contest like Polly, two attorneys or two boxers contesting with one another. Shapot is the word most normally used in its derivatives for krino. Shapot is a, as I've been telling you, a two-legged, two different roots blend in it. And it makes sense because righteousness is not something worked out through experience like the British common law and the covenant people. Righteousness is decreed. It's called apodictic. Justitia distributive doesn't work. The distributing of justice and through common practice and common agreements and long history of norms and social practices produced the British common law. That's the kind of justice that is essentially without meaning in the covenant relationship with God strikes between people. It's like a marriage. There may be common standards, but you make agreements with one another. And that's a covenant. And that covenant Very seldom does it get too much attention in today's world, for better or for worse, sickness or health, richer, poor, till death do us part. That's a covenant. The last will and testament, as I said last Sunday, is a covenant. I write all the terms. You write all the terms of your last will and testament. God, apodictically, if you want the technical term, He dictates it from His mouth, from saying. He says, thou shalt. Not we have learned, we shalt, through much practice and necessities of getting along. Thou shalt. Period. God could define righteousness as climbing a flagpole twice a day. You'd have better shaped Christians. That's what covenant righteousness means. He says what it is. This word, shaphat, embraces two concepts. To rule and to decide or determine between, to judge, to sift out. That's why the word excrement comes from that. It sifts out what shouldn't stay in your body. So I didn't just use excrement to get your attention. All these roots come down to a basic thing. And to judge, and shaphat includes to sift from among, to sift out, to decide, to determine, to pass judgment, decide with a stroke to cut everything apart, and to give ultimate distribution, ultimate decision, ultimate finalization of consequences. That is in the Word. To judge and to rule. Because if you do not rule, how can you enforce the judgment? And if you rule, to whom else can one turn for judgment? Since you have the power to set aside someone else's judgment. Judging requires both the rulership position and rulership in the old tribal cult idea of which, well, these are words we hate in modern democracy, but all the Old Testament covenant people, ritual worship activities and legal bindings and requirements are used with a very respected term. These are the cultic requirements. These are the ritual, covenantal, cultic practices that define them as a people. God chose them. He owns them. And as their owner, we don't like the word slave, but doulos is through the New Testament. And germane to Christianity, you are not your own. You're bought with a price. You're bought with a price. You're not your own. We are not any longer to act as though our life is our own. Jesus' call was a total commitment. He that cometh after me must forsake father, mother, wife, children, brother, sister, yea, and his own life also. And take up his cross, only good for one thing, dying. I said it earlier, he bought the world. He chose a people as his. And he gave them his terms, blessing and cursing. They failed. They so failed that you come to the book of Amos and the prophecy, that covenant relationship left no remainder. All that's left, if they could be found, that keep God's righteousness, kept the terms of the old covenant. The book of Amos says it's like a leg or a piece of an ear out of the mouth of a tiger or a lion. Not much left. And only a faithful God, a loving God, a righteous God who keeps His word, only the Creator, absolute, could work through the facts of the failed covenant on the covenant people's side and transcend it by becoming one of them, kin to us as a kinsman redeemer, and that's the meaning of Christmas. He took upon, we don't have a choice of flesh and blood, He chose it. That He might kin Himself to us, because God's faithful word said only one near of kin could redeem us. He kinned Himself with the covenant people. And He kept the covenant, the only one. And in His perfection, He had the price of redemption, which was required of the kinsman redeemer. And He willingly paid it, and He actually paid it. He gave His life, one worth more than all the world put together, to pay for everybody's failure, and rose to rescue us by the power of His Spirit, who trust Him from the clutches of this evil world and its prince, Satan, and his minions. Thus, He bought anew. Thus, He is the ruler. Thus, He has the power. He has the power to decree the ultimate fate. Philippians 2, my Father's favorite passage. He's been raised above everything, that every knee shall bow. Heaven, earth, hell. All must bow before Him. He's the judge of the universe and the ruler of the universe. He's the judge. And that's why I referred to it last Sunday. Paul said he wouldn't even judge himself. And he is on to the Corinthians for judging him. Because he says, my master, I'm a bondslave. I'm his servant. Let no man trouble me. I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus, stigmata, the brand put in a slave, like we brand cattle, to identify the slave to a particular master. We are bought and paid for. Now that's repulsive to a modern democratic mind, unless you can come to understand what your condition and destiny really is. Without hope, doomed eternally, in the clutches of forces, as Paul called it in the 7th chapter, I repeat, forces that enslave you. You are under the illusion you're free. You're not free. You are enslaved to the world, the flesh, and the devil. And the deliverer offers deliverance and redemption simply for trust, which has no meaning apart from love. It's love, slave, but it's nonetheless in performance, belongingness. He is the judge. How dare you judge me, Paul is saying. Only, I said it to you last Sunday, you ever had anybody criticize your kids? They may need it. This is my kid. My kid. Don't you come in here judging my kid. Any of you ever have those feelings? Go ahead and confess to carnality and humanness. We don't go into... Well, let's go to the... You know, I've had this urge many times. I've gone to the post office, and I've gone to the bank, and I would like to have a voice, direct voice. determining their next check. I would like to have the front page of their evaluation sheet, self-evaluation. I want to evaluate this employee. Seldom do I go to the post office. I don't have that urge. I don't go to post office anymore. I send staff people. Otherwise, I might be in jail. You go to the bank. These tellers, I mean, they're handling money. It's all just paper to them. I mean, it's all the same. Doesn't matter if somebody comes in with a $100,000 deposit or somebody comes in with a dollar deposit. It's all the same, and you're a bother. Get it done. Get out of here. That's my hard-earned money. I would like to evaluate that bank teller. Physically. Which makes me guilty of what I'm about to get to. Only the boss has the right of evaluation. You say, well, business is going to suffer if I don't get to the boss and let him know. Well, make suggestions. But the boss takes the consequence, and therefore, he authors the evaluation, since he takes the responsibility. We don't want to think about this. That's what Eusebian, way back in the first chapter, an unconsciousness about a living God that's with us and watching us every moment. Paul says, you don't have a right to evaluate me. I am the servant of my Lord. His evaluation is the only one that counts. Indeed, he says, I don't even judge myself. Krino, same word. I may think I'm hot stuff. I'm hot stuff for my Lord. I mean, he really thinks highly of me. Paul says, I'm unaware of any shortcoming in carrying out my assignments from my master, but I don't even trust my judgment about myself. He that judgeth me is the Lord. It's okay. We are to examine ourselves whether or not we're in the faith. We ought to work out our salvation with traumas and phobias, which is the cognate of the two Greek, or are the cognates of the two Greek words. There is a healthy nervousness about our condition and our worth to the Lord. That makes us refocus what really counts to Him, because we are continually, with the traditions on us, we're continually shifting gears from the life of faith to evaluating ourselves by what we do for Him. God, when I get a little nervous and understand that what I'm doing may not make Him as happy as He thinks it is. It's not complicated. I have a perennial problem. I've aired it in front of all of you. It seems that no matter who it is that comes here, after they're here a while, they start working for the work. And doing what they think I need, because that gives them a little more ego satisfaction. They're knocking some home runs for old Gene. And they forget they came here to follow me, my signature's on the check, and to do what I want them to do. They want me to want the work that they do. They want me to evaluate their performance that they're high on. They forget. They came here to do what I wanted them to do, not to do what they thought I needed. I'm tired of people doing what they think I need instead of doing what I want. Well, that lets me realize God has the same reaction. His word makes it clear. He's got angels to do what most Christians think He wants. He got angels doing the work that needs to be done. With God,
The work or the end is not as important as the means and the way you do it. With God, the end does not justify the means. The right means guarantee He'll get the correct end. How you do it is more important than what you do. I've been saying this for 26, 27 years. We'll start shortly. On deaf ears. Because the devil still has the control and he motivates through pride. You don't feel as good about yourself doing what somebody wants unless you love them dearly. But if you love yourself more than you love them, you get off on doing what you think needs to be done. The ego's fulfilled and the work accomplished. Devotion. Love. Seeks to please the Master. And Paul says, I honestly don't know of anything I'm doing not faithful to my calling. But he that judgeth me is the Lord. Only the ruler, the one in charge, has the right to judge. You don't have that right. You don't have the luxury of sitting in a critical chair and comparing horizontally and saying, because I'm not like that man, I must be okay. No, you're both not okay. And the distance is about like trying to measure the shadow between me and the Pope and the differential thereof versus the length of both of our shadows combined and the distance from where we're standing to the sun. God's righteousness is so far above. Now, that doesn't mean you cut off the top of your head and quit having opinions. Quit exercising discernment. Paul's going to go right on in the next chapter and tell them how wrong they are to continue to have fellowship as though everything's okay with a man in the church that's committing incest with his father's wife. Throw him out of the fellowship. In Matthew 7, where Jesus talks about judging, and I'll go to that before I close, he goes on to say, don't cast pearls before swine. Don't fellowship and cheapen your gospel with dogs and pigs. That's a judgment. We are to try the spirits, whether or not they be of God when prophets are prophesying. But the criteria is always God's Word, and it's always done in humility as Paul is looking at himself, but he still humbly says, final judgment's God's. But this quick lip, and this flippant attitude, and this cynicism of enculturated Christianity to put yourself in the place of God makes you sin exactly like those in the first chapter. They did not want to accept a creator and a boss. They wanted, with their dialogue and their perverted brains, to come up with a better answer and one that ruled God out of the equation. And then we see what happened to them when God turned them over to the forces of this world and the evil that spewed out of their life. Well, don't make the mistake then of sitting in judgment and doing the same thing they did, taking God's place. We cannot judge in the biblical sense of crino without bringing great danger to ourselves. Go to Matthew 7, that other piece of paper that was handed out to you. Do not judge, Jesus said. Crinete, I want you to see the crino. Derivatives. Do not, crinete, judge, lest you be judged. Me, crithete. For with what judgment, krimati, you judge, krineti, you will be judged, kritha sesli. And with what measure you measure, it will be measured to you. Why do you see the speck in the eye of the brother of you, but do not consider the beam in your eye? How will you say to the brother of you, let me take the speck out of the eye of you, and I'm one-eyed, because there's a beam in my eye? Hypocrite. First take out from the eye of you the beam, and then you will see clearly enough to take out the speck from the eye of the brother. What measure you judge, since God is the ultimate judge, and a failure to recognize it, and the putting of yourself in God's place, which is what the judging that's being condemned here is, consists of, you don't have the right to judge, but the ultimate judge, who will judge your disobedience, will judge you the way you judge. That's why every commentator goes from these passages, as I did the first Sunday, to Nathan, telling the story of the rich man that had many lambs, and he had a guest, and there was one poor man that had one poor lamb that was like his daughter. He had kept it in his home. And the rich man, to feed the guest, takes the poor man's little ewe lamb. And Nathan tells this story to David, and David says, well, I'll kill that guy, and I will take from his lambs and restore to the poor man fourfold. And Nathan said, thou art the man, with wives and concubines aplenty in the culture of that day. He stole Bathsheba. It's so easy to see the faults of others and get self-righteously judgmental and not see yourself. I get amazed at the way the devil takes over staff members of mine. Because if they fall out of the Spirit, if they grieve the Spirit away with some self-serving maneuver, then they're right back in the clutches of Satan. And it always amazes me how clear their vision is when it's somebody else doing it. But when they're doing it, you can't get through their head with a billy club. They're excuse makers. Judging is a sin. But the kind of judging that is done here, Paul gets declarative in the rest of the verse. Wherein? He's not arguing. He didn't argue in the first chapter. He declared it. God has left enough tracks in the universe. He deserves to be recognized, his presence practiced, thanksgiving garnered, and worship for what he's provided you. Failure to do it, God turns you over. And your senseless heart becomes perverted until you end the chapter even approving the things that you know deserve death. Now, in this second chapter, he's not going to defend. He's not going to reason. He's not out to prove a point. He's declaring a point. Which every one of us know. Woe unto you, O man, that judges another for these things of that first chapter. Wherein you that judge the other one are guilty of doing the same things, which makes your judging hypocrisy quintessential to the maximum. Oh, no. not the saints sitting here today, guilty of those terrible sins? Well, Paul says you are. That the very act of judging reveals the face of God in your conscience, that recognizes these things are wrong, and you are therefore thrusting forth your judgment against them, and by implication saying, how terrible, I don't do that. And I would bet, in this congregation, as we went through that first chapter, you didn't think you were guilty. You didn't think you were doing those things. You didn't think, for example, you were guilty of wickedness. Well, the word is adikaios. A negative particle means not righteous. Anything that's opposed to divine law and character. Well, now we know we all start in that position. So it's just a matter of quantitative degree, not qualitative exception. There isn't anybody in this congregation that isn't unrighteous under the standard of the law. So how dare you judge someone as unredeemable and beyond the reversal of God's turnover because they're unrighteous? When by the same sense, they don't know the gospel. These are those that only saw creation. And because they didn't recognize God, worship Him, and live with a constant awareness and thanksgiving of His presence, God turned them over. They didn't have what we have, the gospel and the knowledge. We have in our conscience a recognition that that's wrong. We shouldn't be doing it. By the very fact that you judge is proof positive, you know it shouldn't be done. Guilty of the same thing. And if you have come to a knowledge of faith, and have quit walking from faith to faith, and have gone back to putting your trust into and your Christianity like driving on the freeway, you don't even have to think about it, you're guilty. Same things. What about the second one? Porneia. It's an inclination to evil, to take pleasure in evil. Well, now, former things have passed away for the Christians, but is there anybody here going to stand up and tell me in the last year you never had an inclination to take pleasure in something evil? Well, I guess so, sir. You're guilty. Now, this is why I don't like this message. I don't like this subject. Greed. Pleonexia. Covetousness. It was in the 10th of the 10 commandments. It's a passion for more. Wanting what somebody else has, wishing you had it. Anybody ever had thought like that? So don't sit there and say, as you judge, you're not guilty. I'll bet you every one of the pastors criticizing, judging me out there would give their right arm today if they could handle a congregation and still be there the way I just did. They've been kissing asteroid for Jesus for so long, they don't know how to exercise the role of a domitor. They have the authority of Dale Carnegie, manipulative authority. They're judging me because I smoke a cigar. Wish I'd brought one today. I'd light it up right now. Taking pleasure in evil things. Depravity. That word means maliciousness. It delights in doing other people harm. harm with words, gossiping. There are some, probably in my congregation, that have taken somebody to the cleaners in some business deal. Well, they may have deserved it. The way they learn to live in this hard world. But the taking, it's not only a bad deed, but when you drink that glass of orange juice to celebrate it, and you brag to your friends, I sure took him for a bundle. Guilty. That's what these words mean. We're so, you know, everybody's in such shock because of the sexual abnormalities described early on in the turnover condition of Romans 1. You sort of skip over those other 21 sins and decide, since you're not guilty of the first category, you must not be guilty of anything. Envy. Anybody ever had envy? In ancient Greece, there was a man whose name was Aristides. He was a great man and was called Aristides the Just. But he was put on trial for something, as many just men were, and a citizen of Athens came to him, not knowing who he was, and asked him to vote for his own banishment. Aristides asked, "But what harm has Aristides done to you?" The man said, "None. I'm just tired of hearing him called Aristides the Just." Envy. Envy. Envy of God's blessing. Murder. Murder. The Greek word for murder, phonu, sounds like the word for envy, pathonu, which is why they probably appear together so much, because that's where the first murder came from. Cain envied Abel. Murder. Well, I'm not a murderer. By Jesus' definition, we all are. Jesus said, you hate somebody in your heart, you're guilty of murder. Now again, I'm not preaching this to send everybody out of here crawling below the seats, afraid to peek outside because you think there's a light now flashing from your forehead saying, sinner, sinner, sinner. I want it to flash in your heart. The whole purpose of this that Paul is doing is to get us to understand how helpless we are and how glorious the gospel is that came to such as us. He didn't judge us. He took our judgment on himself. And he bought us with his own precious blood. And only he has the right as ruler and judge. Do I have the right to recognize an envious person? Yes, if I will look in the mirror at the same time. There, but for the grace of God, I'd be more like him. I said you don't cut your head off. A murderer is a murderer. But he is capable of being a recipient of the same grace of God that comes to me who's been guilty of hating, which according to Jesus is likewise murder. Strife, wrangling, quarreling, arguing, a natural trait of humankind. Deceit. You ever deceived? Tongues of the wicked practice this vice. You ever deceive? You ever march around with a front that you know is false, designed to get you something? These are the sins of the first chapter. Malice. This is from two Greek words. Kakos and cacophony. Cacophony is a bad or discordant sound. Ethos, which means habit, custom or usage. Customary, habitual, evil, set against other people. Then the central sins are gossips. Did you ever gossip? The Greek word is sthristes. Slanderers, they carry gossip one step further. Secret is gossip, slanders open. Even the world allows litigation for slander. God haters. How could God let this happen to me? I'm not a God hater. Oh, yes, you are occasionally. How could God let this happen to me? After all I've done for him. Insolent. The great Greek word hubris, which means pride, sets a human being up against God. Arrogant. Invent evil ways. Disobey parents. Senseless, faithless, heartless, ruthless. What Paul is saying, as we've seen, what happens to those that are turned over to the forces of evil. And you're sitting here judging them. I'm telling you, that reveals a knowledge, and the knowledge condemns you. And where you're judging them, you're guilty yourself of doing the very same things. Now, it's okay to judge the things as wrong, as long as you include yourself in the target zone. As long as you understand, you're in no position to judge one that is bought and paid for by the price of Jesus' precious blood. I belong to him. You belong to him. I'm bound to him in love. In this sinful condition, he gave himself for me. How dare I intrude past the deeds that I see and self-examination that I recognize the same tendencies apart from the grace of God in each of us? And how dare I wrap righteous robes around me like the Pharisee and say, I think, my God, I'm not like that other man. How dare I play the hypocrite, even to myself, and presume God's right to determine destiny and condition of someone because of deeds thought to be perceived. I'm tired of the hypocritical judges. I'm tired of those that judge me constantly out of the church world to which I gave many years of my life and service. I said to some prominent minister recently, you really think that Isaiah would have been invited to a Christian talk show while he was running butt naked 3.5 years up and down the streets of Jerusalem? And he leaned forward and said, he did what? God told him to do it. He that judgeth me is the Lord. The message speaks for itself. And it's a serious want of respect for God to think that a message can be right from a wrong messenger. Can a bad tree, a poison tree, give forth good fruit? No. for all of you today, I have just one message, and it's the message of Paul. The gospel is needed for all of us. Without the gospel, we're without hope, and the distance, as I said, is from here to the sun, not the shadows between us. The gospel is God's rescue, but it's not going to rescue anybody that doesn't know they need to be rescued. I need to be rescued. I think you need to be rescued. Live in that state. That's my message. At 7 o'clock, King's House 1, Miracle Service. Make your reservations if you haven't. Voices of Faith, be there this afternoon to take the calls. God bless America. Good day, folks.